Wow. I think that's all I'm going to say. Just wow. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Rima Jerez, in for Kai Rizdal. It is Friday, August 5th. Good to have you with us. So, the jobs report for July. When it came out this morning, fair to say a bunch of jaws hit the floor. Employers added 528,000 jobs in July, double what economists were expecting. And the unemployment rate fell 0.1% to 3.5%. We saw big job gains in leisure and hospitality, healthcare, retail, also in construction and finance. We're going to break it all down in a minute with our weekly wrap. But first, Mitchell Hartman gets us going.
July 2022 will go down in history as the month when the total number of jobs in the economy surpassed the level just before the pandemic hit in February 2020, and when the unemployment rate finally fell back to its pre-pandemic level. What's it all signify?
Competence.
Becky Frankowitz is president for North America at staffing firm Manpower Group.
All of the economic indicators are signaling caution, caution, caution. And yet the American worker and American employers are saying competence, competence, competence.
Frankowitz says we're emerging from the pandemic period with consumers still spending it up on goods and services and employers still trying desperately to hire enough workers to supply them. And we need all of that to keep going, says Robert Frick at Navy Federal Credit Union, because there's still more ground to recover.
Yeah, we're back to the pre-pandemic level. But if you look to the pre-pandemic trend, we're 4 or 5 million jobs below that.
That's because the economy was chugging along in February 2020, and absent COVID, it would have added more jobs by now. Going forward, Frick says we'll need to keep adding jobs.
Millennials continue to want goods and services. Healthcare needs to rebuild after COVID dropped a bomb on it. Childcare and daycare need to rebuild.
And in fact, while overall payroll employment is now back to pre-pandemic levels, some sectors are still way behind where they were. Leisure and hospitality, for instance, education and government. And there's one other key way the economy is different than it was before the pandemic, wage growth. Mike Fratantoni is with the Mortgage Bankers Association.
So wage growth picked up to 5.2%, a symptom that we still have almost 11 million job openings at a time when businesses were already struggling to hire.
Before the pandemic, wages were rising just over 3% a year. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
All right, now to get into things a bit more, I've got Sudeep Reddy from Politico and Gina Smilak with the New York Times. Hey, you two.
Hey, Rima.
Hey, Rima.
So, Gina, imagine you are Jay Powell. How are you feeling right now? How are you? What are you thinking as the chair of the Fed when you see this jobs report?
Yeah, this is a tough one for Chair Powell. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got a situation here where they have been waiting to see some kind of slowdown in jobs growth. They've really wanted to see a moderation in sort of the pace of economic expansion. And instead, what they're getting is just sign after sign mm-hmm. that the economy remains very hot. And so I think they are really struggling with that. Obviously, the Fed has been raising rates at a pretty quick pace this year. And I think this probably suggests to them that they need to keep that up.
Mm-hmm. So he's probably a little stressed. Sudeep, where do you think this puts us on the path to a soft landing, the so-called soft landing?
You know, if you're sitting there, if you're sitting in Jay Powell's chairman's chair right now, mm-hmm. you see that you've raised interest rates over and over and over, and you still have not broken the labor market, mm-hmm. that's actually a comforting place to be. It shows that the Fed's policies can actually take their time. You get them into the system. It doesn't mean, though, that that they're actually successful. Inflation's coming down, but not coming down fast enough. And so they're really going to have to work hard at figuring out how to push rates up even higher to just bring some of the slack into the economy. There's just none of that right now when it comes to the labor market.
Right. And Gina, you know, there's obviously been a lot of talk about, are we in a recession? Are we not? Is it coming? But I feel like that might not be the right question anymore when you have a jobs report like this, right?
it sure as heck does not look like a recession out there.
Yeah.
You know, this is clearly a very strong economy for workers. There, as we know, there are a lot of job openings. People are clearly taking those positions and they're getting paid a lot more as they do that. I think that the real question is, what is this economy? Because obviously we're in a situation where if you talk to consumers, they feel really badly about the way things are going. You know, I don't think we want to minimize that experience. People don't feel good about the economy right now. I think it's just very much unlike anything that we're used to. This economy sort of doesn't fit in our normal paradigm for what is a good economy or what is a bad economy.
Mm-hmm. And so if inflation doesn't come down, what is the fear?
I think that the real danger here is that consumers are going to increasingly struggle to keep up with these prices, and you're really going to see the poorest members of society hit in a very painful way that they really can't do anything about. You know, I think when we talk about inflation, obviously it's not the kind of problem that hits everybody across society the same way. What we see is poor people already starting to pull back on spending on necessities like food. And so, you know, that's a very dangerous situation if it continues.
Mm-hmm. And I think there's a fear that the prices could become entrenched too, right?
Yes, absolutely. That's certainly the problem. You know, if we continue to see wage growth going up this quickly, if we continue to see this kind of sort of robust activity level in the economy as a whole, the danger is that we just get inflation that lasts year after year, month after month, and that consumer psychology around inflation really changes. Mm-hmm. And then we can have a situation where it's much harder to get rid of down the road.
Mm-hmm. And last week, Sudeep, you were on the show and you said that the economy felt wobbly, was the word you used. How are things looking now on the wobbliness meter with a jobs report like this?
You know, you've got a strong jobs report, which is obviously the backbone of the entire economy. And so you have to look at this and say things are pretty good. When you're this tight in the labor market, when you have so little slack, it's a good place to be overall. There are other signs, though. Just this week, we've seen day after day announcements about corporate layoffs. Those are the early signs of how the slowdown begins. But we have not come anywhere close to seeing a meaningful pullback in the overall economy. And if we can stay in this position, we're great. But there are enough mounting signs of other problems. There are inventories that have obviously piled up in a lot of retailers. There's still just angst across the board, partly due to inflation, but just partly due to the overall state of the world. It is why this is such a weird place to be right now, because you've never seen so many people talking about a recession, which isn't happening, while the job market is so tight. Like,
it's
this is
so
the opposite
confusing.
Of a recession.
Yeah. Gina, you had this really great Twitter thread this morning that I retweeted, where you answered a question you get a lot from readers, and it is a good, fair question. And just if you could explain it simply, like, why does the Fed want to slow down the labor market?
Right. I think this is not intuitive.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, it feels like we should be celebrating a very strong job market and very solid wage gains. But from the Fed's perspective, if you have wage gains like we're seeing now, they basically make it impossible for inflation to move back down to the Fed's goal over the longer term. You know, companies cannot pay out 5.2% annual pay increases, but only charge a little bit more for their products. They're eventually going to go out of business if they do that, because it's going to eat into their profits so much. And so the idea is that this is the kind of wage growth that locks high inflation in the longer term, and that's not sustainable for workers either. Because if you're a worker in America right now, in all likelihood, your pay gains, while strong, are probably not actually keeping up with the rising cost of living. And so the Fed's logic here is that to set the economy on a sustainable, positive path in the long run, you have to slow down conditions today, get this inflation under control, and then we might have some hope for real meaningful wage growth that workers can actually take home and kind of keep in the bank in the longer run. And so that's sort of the logic that the Fed applies when it thinks about getting the inflation under control and getting the economy back into a solid place.
Mm-hmm. And Sudeep, I think last question here. It seems like the Biden administration is very happy with this report. I don't know, can it take a victory lap for the economy this week?
They absolutely can take some comfort in what's happened with the economy. The fact that there's so much chatter over the last few weeks about recession, and we're not there yet. They're obviously achieving some relief on gas prices for 51 days straight of declines, and obviously being on the cusp of achieving some big legislation that have been longtime Democratic priorities on on climate and some on healthcare. That is a lot to accomplish. It's always risky to take a victory lap in early August because the second half of August always often turns ugly for presidents. But so far, they've got to be feeling pretty good right now.
We shall see. Always great talking with y'all. Sudeep Reddy is with Politico and Gina Smilak is with The New York Times. Thanks, you two. Hope you have a good weekend.
Thanks, Rima.
Thanks, Rima.
On Wall Street today, things wavered. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. So the numbers in this report, they show us that workers, they are in good shape because with this tight labor market, they are the ones with the upper hand. And that gives them more flexibility, right? More freedom, more of a safety net, if you will. And not just to find a job, but maybe also to venture out. For today's installment of our series, My Economy, we hear from a new grad who recently decided to create a job for herself.
My name is Devin Tormey. I'm located in Fitchburg, Massachusetts, and I am an artist who specializes in wedding paintings. I've been an artist probably since I was a child, you know, starting small and working my way up, doing different mediums, experimenting with different things, learning, and you know, throughout school and in my classes. I felt very confident in my artistic ability when I left high school. But I, quite honestly, was not sure what I wanted to do with my life. Everybody in my life had gone into a business path. The people in my family were very supportive of me either way. I know that art is something that I'm very interested in, something that I'm naturally good at, but I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to make money doing it. My senior year of college, I'm in the honors program, and a requirement is a senior thesis capstone project. I had been speaking with my honors thesis advisor, and despite him being a business major, we had a really in-depth conversation about, you know, his creative side and about my creative side and how anybody can work in business, but not everybody can create art. And he said, I will guide you along this process of you writing a business plan to become a full-time artist. If and only if you follow through with it, you need to put the plan into action afterwards, and you are going to surprise yourself. I've already made $20,000 within the last 4 months running this business. And my first wedding, I had the sweetest couple. They had asked me to paint their first kiss, which was outside at a gazebo overlooking the golf course. And I was really excited about it because there was lots of greenery. There was a beautiful blue sky. You know, the architecture of the gazebo was very, you know, interesting to paint as well. And then, you know, just painting the couple, they just fit right in there. It looked, all the colors kind of came together. And I was excited about the composition. It was very centered, but I think that it was very centered on them. And even though it was a little bit stressful here and there, and my feet hurt after painting, you know, and standing up for 7 hours, at the end of the night, I was pretty excited about how it looked. And when I got to deliver it, it was wonderful.
That was Devin Tormey over in Massachusetts. Now, as a reminder, we cannot do this series without you. So please head on over to marketplace.org and let us know what's going on in your economy. Coming up,
90s fashion sort of made a comeback.
Love to hear that. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones gained 76 points, 0.2%, to end at 32,803. The Nasdaq lost 63 points, 0.5%, to close at 12,657. And the S&P 500 shed 6 points, 0.1%, to finish at 4,145. For the week, the Dow lost 0.1%, the Nasdaq rose 0.2%, and the S&P rose 0.3%. We saw in the jobs report that some sectors are even bigger than they were before the pandemic, including construction and retail. Looking at some of those stocks, Vulcan Materials grew 0.9%, Home Depot raised 0.8%. Coming up on the first weekend in August, 2,345,429 people passed through TSA checkpoints yesterday. That's over 300,000 more that passed through the same date last year, but fewer than before the pandemic. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.84%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Rima Khreis. For the last 20 years or so, those robot vacuum cleaners, known as Roombas, have been roaming around our homes, confounding cats and dogs, sometimes babies, while they suck up dirt and the occasional sock. Today, Amazon, which, by the way, is a Marketplace underwriter, announced it's buying the maker of those Roombas, the company iRobot, for $1.7 billion. iRobot also sells robot mops, air purifiers, and replacement parts to keep all those machines going. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes explains what this acquisition says about our domesticated robot future.
In the 1960s cartoon The Jetsons, there's this moment where the mom, Jane, presses a button, and a little blue robot starts to vacuum the living room.
Pick up your feet, please. Pick up your feet, please.
It also cleans out an ashtray and pours her a cup of coffee. The Jetsons was set around 2062, and parts of the smart home it imagined, including robot vacuums and video calls, are already a reality. And during the pandemic, robots took on a lot more tasks.
This is a tipping point.
Robin Murphy, a roboticist at Texas A&M, led a study that found people got more comfortable using robots to do things like disinfect surfaces and deliver food.
So we've really seen in the past 2 years, robots go for something that you might have for military or highly specialized uses. But now it's like, oh, yeah, sure, robots everywhere.
That includes smart assistants like Amazon's Alexa. The market for smart home devices grew nearly 12% last year worldwide, with Amazon as the market leader in the U.S. That's according to Adam Wright with the research firm IDC. He says Amazon's acquisition of iRobot means Alexa could control a household army of Roombas.
And say, hey, you know, we see that there's an upcoming event on your calendar. You should probably run your robot in the home and clean the home before you have visitors.
All those robot vacuums and mops will also provide Amazon with more data about, say, the layout of customers' living rooms.
Consumers are concerned about digital privacy and security, but more often than not, we're happy to push those concerns to the back of our minds in favor of convenience.
And consumers today, unlike Jane Jetson, are more aware they're paying for that convenience with personal data. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
When I was a kid and my mom would drag me to the mall, the only saving grace, the thing that would keep me from whining and pouting the whole way there, was knowing that I'd be able to shop at Claire's. You know, the store that looks like it just threw up glitter and purple and pink and has every possible bejeweled earring and necklace an 8-year-old girl would want. Yeah, that one. Back in 2018, you may remember the company was not doing so well. It shut down dozens of its stores across the country. But now you could say it's having a bit of a comeback. Elizabeth Segran is a senior staff writer at Fast Company, and she recently wrote about all of this, and she joins me now. Elizabeth, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I read your article, and it sounds like I'm not the only one in this interview who has very distinct memories of shopping at Claire's as a kid.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. My whole tween years were, all of the memories of my tween years are like dominated by going to Claire's.
Same. But, you know, I was really surprised to learn that not only is it still around, but it's, you know, it's thriving. So before we get into the reasons, can you give us a better sense of financially how this legacy business is doing?
So it was actually founded in 1971, but its revenues were deeply tied to the success of the mall. Mm-hmm. And as the mall sort of declined as a hotspot, its sales began to go down. And in 2018, it actually filed for bankruptcy. But in a really remarkable turnaround story, over the last 4 years, not only has its executive team managed to get it out of bankruptcy, mm-hmm. it's now headed for an IPO that could raise up to $100 million. And last year, it had revenues of $1.4 billion.
Wow. Okay, so let's talk about this big comeback. How did it go from filing for bankruptcy to filing for an IPO?
Well, it's basically, the mall is not completely dead. That's their fundamental belief. Mm. But there are some malls that are doing really well. And so the key for them is, number one, making sure that their stores are in these kind of more prestigious malls. But their other really interesting strategy has been to set up stores not in malls. So you might go into CVS and see like a little mini Claire's aisle, even a grocery store, and there might be a little Claire's section there.
Right. Okay. So that strategy seems pretty straightforward, bringing Claire's to locations where customers are already shopping.
Totally.
And how much of its success has to do with just the fashion and market trends we're currently seeing?
Well, so I think the part of the brand's recent success was that, 90s fashion sort of made a comeback.
It is back.
Totally back. Yeah. And so scrunchies were super in, and Claire's was just like abounding in scrunchies. The company actually has a really great supply chain, and it's been working with some of its factory partners for decades and is able to respond to trends really, really quickly. Mm-hmm. And that's part of its success.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mentioned in your article there's a team of trend spotters who just travel the world figuring out what might be the next popular thing.
I kind of want that job.
It sounds so interesting. Also, going back to something you said about the scrunchies, there was also this really nice detail in your article where you wrote how, I think back in 2019, scrunchies were a massive trend because teenager boys would wear them to indicate that they had a girlfriend. And so Claire's was like, I'm on it. And they churned out millions of scrunchies, which I find hilarious.
Yeah, I mean, and what was so interesting about that is that, they could see that trend coming several years ahead.
And it's interesting that, to your point, they were kind of well-suited in a way for the pandemic and the consequent supply chain issues we saw. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Totally. When ships were grounded and they weren't able to ship over products, they were able to put them on aircraft and fly them over. And because they sell such tiny little objects, they were able to really pack a lot into, a container that would go on a plane. And so all of the supply chain issues really haven't been a problem for Claire's.
Gotcha. So Claire's is now kind of a case study in what it can take for legacy businesses to survive. But what do you think will ensure its success moving forward?
So I think that what Claire's has been able to do is that even though it's a large legacy business, it's been very nimble and it's been looking out for opportunities to go into places that customers are already going to. If malls continue to decline, it seems like Claire's is ready to pop up on your street corner instead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if there's anything I'm taking away from this conversation is that there will always be a demand among tweens for bejeweled pizza earrings and strawberry lip gloss.
Oh, my gosh. And maybe even for their parents.
Exactly. Elizabeth Segran is a senior staff writer at Fast Company. Thanks so much for your time, Elizabeth.
Thank you for having me.
This final note on the way out today. We started the show, of course, talking about jobs and this strong labor market we're in. And I feel the need to share this article I came across this morning in the Wall Street Journal that kind of obnoxiously shows how the scramble for workers is hitting all sorts of industries and people, including the uber wealthy. Like, I'm talking the super rich. Apparently, they are in dire need of executive assistants, or even what they call a chief of staff. According to this article, they can make up to $400,000 for doing everything from prepping for board meetings to managing housekeepers, basically just being on call 24/7. I don't know, just throwing that out there if anyone's looking for a job. All right, we got to go. But first, your moment of economic context. Now, if we dig just a little deeper in the July jobs report, we see that women actually drove a lot of the job gains. They counted for more than half of the increase in payrolls. Overall, women are recovering more quickly than men, even though they took a bigger hit early on in the pandemic when millions of them left the workforce. Right now, 55% of women are employed compared to 55.9% back in early 2020. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fergali. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. And I'm Rima Khreis. Have a good weekend, everyone. We'll be back on Monday. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.